This is a Digital Music Trends 142 recorded on the 24th of July 2013. This week on the show, the White House and private initiatives against piracy, Amy Mann versus MediaNet, Pandora and potential new bills, copyright review in the US, Gigit and more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends, the weekly show where we try and make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And Digital Music Trends is available on a variety of channels, including iTunes, most podcatchers, SoundCloud, YouTube, Mixcloud and more. And you can email feedback to contact@digitalmusictrends.com. And this week, I'm really happy to introduce three great guests on the show, starting with Cristelia Garcia, visiting professor of law at the George Washington University. So hi, Cristelia, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Hi, I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And also on the show, great to have Zach Greenberg, senior editor at Forbes, where he covers the business of music and entertainment. So hey, Zach, and great to have you on. How's it going?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. And it's also great to have back on the show Zach Carter, or Zachary, I guess, because we have two Zachs today. It's going to be hard to point you out. Senior political economy reporter at the Huffington Post. So how's it going?
Just fine. Thanks for having me back.
It's great. So let's delve right into it, as Cristelia is only about 20 minutes with us. And this week, we're going to stay stateside for the majority of the show. It's actually quite a slow news week, which is good, because usually we have to go through 100 things in just under an hour. And we're going to kick off by discussing the latest announcement by the White House Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, Victoria Espinel. This was made last week in a blog post, where she announced a new initiative that sees the likes of Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and AOL come together to combat piracy, primarily by reducing the financial incentives to piracy itself. So essentially, this means that they're going to cut off sites that contain primarily pirated content from the likes of Google AdWords, for example, and thus reducing the profitability of the sites and the incentive to exist, essentially. So the White House has held private initiatives as an important part of the agenda for fighting piracy. And Victoria Espinel also spoke at the World Creators Summit last month in DC, where I was. And she addressed those points particularly. So this seems to echo her feelings on the importance of private initiatives. How do you feel about this new development? Do you feel like it's a victory for the music industry? And will it have any effects? Cristelia, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm happy to start. I think it's interesting and it's absolutely reflective of a trend that we're seeing both a push from the government side and a push from the corporate side to have more private solutions to these problems, in part perhaps because governmental and regulatory solutions haven't proven that effective. But also I think perhaps because there is a greater chance of effectiveness for a lot of the private solutions in the academy. A lot of law and economic types have been looking for some time at emerging phenomenon. A lot of what my team looks at, for example, seeing private deals improve efficiency where, for example, the statutory license for performance rights, for example, doesn't do as good a job. We see companies like Clear Channel and Big Machine negotiating their own private deals to a more effective result. We've seen Sony ATV, for example, one of the nation's largest publishers, withdraw its content from ASCAP and begin negotiating private deals. And they're advertising, more effective results. So I think the idea is that, well, if we can get more effective results through private ordering in these ways, maybe we'll get more effective results when we private order vis-a-vis infringement as well. I think there's a lot of reasons to believe that is true. If it's effective, that doesn't mean that there's not concerns resulting from this. Of course, there's nothing that will necessarily be a foolproof result. And at least on the business side, we've seen that private ordering is great and efficient for the parties involved, but it's not necessarily efficient for the parties who are not involved, the smaller guys, who can't get a piece of the action, and it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the infringement context.
Yeah, sure. And Zach, on the entertainment front, how do you feel like the labels are going to perceive this move, and do you think they feel like this is a victory of something they've been advocating for a long time now?
I think so for sure. I think Cristelia really, basically said it all, but I think there've been a lot of efforts like this over the years to try to, make sure that musicians and record companies get paid for music they put up. And I think that, this is another step, in the right direction. I mean, how much of an effect it'll have immediately on artists' bottom lines, I think remains to be seen. I think especially when it comes to things like streaming and that sort of thing, we're still kind of in the infancy here in terms of artists actually getting compensated, and adoption is relatively low compared to still terrestrial radio. So artists aren't kind of quite reaping the rewards that perhaps they'd hoped yet, as we've seen in the news this week from Tom York and so forth. But I think it's really important to set up this framework in advance, so in potentially a few years down the road, and however long, when streaming does become as I think it will, the dominant way people will listen, and that people will be only consuming more and more music online, that these structures are set up correctly and in a way that will fairly compensate artists. So I think it's definitely a step.
Yeah, and Zach, on a more general note, in light of the Prism revelations of the past month, of course, one has to wonder whether it's a good time to talk about a joint initiative between the government and the biggest internet providers in the world, and whether also the fact that it was announced fairly quietly in a blog post is a resonance of this feeling that the public doesn't really want to hear too much about government-led initiatives with such big providers. Do you feel like that's a fair comment to make?
I think to some extent that's a fair comment, but I also think, Victoria Espinel's job, she's the intellectual property coordinator at the White House. I mean, her job in large part is just to sort of ameliorate concerns from within the industry that the administration can't really do anything about from a more concrete policy perspective. Most of these groups, I mean, she basically ends up doing stuff on trade policy or other types of symbolic actions that basically benefit big record labels, big movie studios, or pharmaceutical companies, but don't actually end up creating any sort of concrete policy change. And I think this is kind of something that is stemming out of the failure of SOPA a couple of years ago. Most of these companies were all pushing really hard for the Stop Online Piracy Act, and that fell apart in large part because, politically at least, it really ran afoul of the tech industry. And so here you have, a lot of tech companies, Google, et cetera, working with these record labels to try and make things look pretty good and look like everybody's getting along. But I think in reality, the ways that the music industry here being the record labels, want to deal with piracy fundamentally are at odds with the ways that most tech companies want to handle their own businesses. So yeah. I think you'll see some difference at the margins here, but I don't think this is going to make a huge difference in the way music is distributed and the way it's trafficked. And I also think it's really interesting though that as the way we talk about this too, the streaming companies have sort of become the like anti-artist whipping boy lately. It's these record labels that 10, 15 years ago were getting pilloried for having poor standards for artist payment are now sort of seen as like, oh, well, these guys are kind of good. If we want artists to get paid, we got to pay the record labels first. And I think from a public relations perspective, that's an interesting change.
Either of you guys had anything to add to that?
Well, I would just say that I agree. I think he's really hit the nail on the head. I've found it very interesting to see the having worked in record labels for a large portion of my professional career, I find it fascinating to sort of pass the buck, if you will, to yes, indeed, look at how the streaming companies are ripping off artists when that blame was just very recently placed upon record labels, and I guess to some extent still is. I think the more interesting question that sort of stems from initiatives like this is what is the alternative? Do we really think that if we don't have streaming services that this will improve music sales, or will it be as the streaming services would argue, well, they're either going to pay you pennies on the dollar or they're going to steal, and those are the only two options? And I think that initiatives like this are at least trying to explore their options, even if they are in fact simply a band-aid to sort of appease labels who didn't get SOPA in the way that they wanted. So it's
absolutely
interesting.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to stay with you for a second, because there was another story that came out about a month ago, but I haven't really addressed on the show because I never had the right guests to do so. So as far as legislation is concerned aimed at punishing users or downloaders of pirated content, I think the US government, we can fairly say that has steered well away from that general direction, especially in the backlash of the RIAA lawsuits. And seeing how initiatives like Hadopi in France, for example, haven't exactly paid off, We've seen France abandoning that to a large extent last month. So in February, though, in the US, a six-strike system derived from a collaboration between RIAA, MMPA, and five US ISPs started seeing the light as part of the Center for Copyright Information, which was news to me. I never heard about this center. I think it was founded, actually, in light of this new agreement, I guess. And after reports of a few warning emails sent by Comcast, Warner Cable last month announced that they're going to start to implement this gradually. It's going to be a system where they can educate the public about not downloading illegal material and about the risks of doing so in terms of viruses and all sorts of other stuff that can happen when you go on P2P networks. So first up, what are your thoughts on the Center for Copyright Information, and what kind of is it like a completely privately led initiative? Does it have any type of mandate?
I like you don't know a lot about the center. I learned of it in surrounding the same information that you did. Right. I do suspect that it was formed largely for that purpose. So I don't know exactly what the mandate would be. I imagine that it also has something of a sort of appeasement effect or goal that it's supposed to be there to respond to industry concerns and attempt to alleviate where it can. I gather this from the fact that the policy which they've passed, which is neither here nor there in terms of, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing to have necessarily, but it's clearly something that is in response to demands from the record labels. Yeah. And I don't have to re-comment on all the commentary that's been out there, that it clearly is at odds with the business goals of the ISPs who would be having to put it into effect, which is why there's a lot of questions around the efficacy of such a system where, every ISP can set its own, sort of punishments, if you will, or its own, there's no requirement as to what they have to do, and there's really no incentive for them to cut off customers who are paying. Yeah. So that is it more of a slap on the wrist? Is there a deterrent effect just to the threat for people who get the warning and are scared by it? Or once people realize that it's a warning and nothing else, is it really not going to accomplish anything? The bigger question is sort of what are the efficacy of systems like this, and if this new Copyright Center is charged with that, I would say they should consider perhaps looking at, as you mentioned, the failure of these systems in other countries and other regimes such as France, and maybe it's time we consider something more of a reward system. We've seen that the stick isn't always effective. Maybe a carrot would be more effective, and there are some proposals out there that would actually argue for a subsidized system wherein people who don't get caught, get certain perks. They get faster connections, nice, or they get whatever. So, absolutely. I think that there's some action out there to say that if we are going to have a center whose mandate is to do these sorts of things, maybe it can be done more effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And Zach, you're in New York, where Time Warner is, I guess, a war for many. Many of you New Yorkers have heard horror stories about the service over there. And how do you feel people would react to start getting notifications about their internet usage? Do you feel like after the whole RIAA debacle, people are aware that what they're downloading is being really monitored? And do you think there could be any backlash from them, from operators just showing up to your door and saying, we downloaded this, and we've seen exactly what you've done, and we know what you're doing online?
Yeah, Time Warner would not really be winning any popularity contests, and I don't think they are anyway around here.
No, exactly.
I think, again, it's a step in the right direction, but I think it's just going to come down to, more broadly in the music industry, can products like Spotify and continue to be delivered? The music industry continue to to find ways to produce products that are more appealing than going on and illegally downloading something? I think that's where this war is going to be won. And I think that's why Spotify, for example, is such an important entity, in this battle, because it's like, well, why would you want to go through the trouble of going to BitTorrent or whatever? And especially something that's not very user friendly for the less tech savvy people in the world, when you can just go on Spotify and hear anything you want for free,
essentially. Yeah. And Zach, from your perspective, do you feel like this is something that is just an appeasement proposition? The whole initiative, the whole CPI or whatever the acronym is for it.
Yeah.
And is there any other reason for it to exist other than make sure the RIAA and the MPAA are happy?
I mean, the Center for Copyright Information is an industry front group, essentially. Like, and there are a lot of these groups. So instead of having to have it be like, you know, Warner Music or Columbia Records or something,
I met a lot of them in Washington last month.
Yeah, right. It's a town full of them. You know, there's this sort of, you know, more cuddly sort of front group that can pursue this agenda. But I would say one thing about the Center for Copyright Information that's different from a lot of these other front groups is that their board does include Gigi Sohn, who is the founder of Public Knowledge. And Gigi is one of the, at least in Washington, one of the most respected people who typically takes the side opposite from the record labels on copyright issues, thinking sort of more about how copyright intellectual property ought to be structured to you know, create a better user experience for people, not just necessarily to create larger profit margins for copyright rights holders.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that means that this has the potential to I think be a little more interesting than most of the traditional industry front groups would be, but you know, if they're coming out of the gate by talking about scaring people away from pirating stuff, I mean, I just think in practice this hasn't worked. It doesn't work. If you want people to stop pirating things, you really have to offer them a better, more accessible alternative. And I think programs like Spotify and Pandora are really easy to use, and they are really accessible. But Gigi would be, I think, the first to acknowledge that so far the business model and the intellectual property framework in which they're required to operate isn't really ideal yet.
Yeah, sure. And Cristela, I just wanted to ask you before you have to go about the copyright review. And you were mentioning at the beginning of the show there's going to be some hearings tomorrow from artists that you're going to be going to. So can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening tomorrow and how that fits into the copyright review framework?
Sure. So a while back, I guess in the early spring, the Register of Copyrights, Mira Pallante, testified and mentioned to Congress, or she pushed Congress to for a full revamp of the copyright laws, and it's, you know, being widely called, you know, the next great copyright act, and did get Congress interested in actually looking at a full review of the copyright. And this would be the first time we've had anything like this, you know, since the 70s when the Copyright Act that we're currently operating under was passed. And so if you think about all of the technological and even just consumer preferential changes that have happened from the 70s to now, and notwithstanding a little rash of, you know, amendments like the DMCA that happened in the 90s, even from 95 when that was going on, in 98 with the latest amendments, it's, you know, a world of difference. So we're way overdue for a reconsideration of these things. It's complicated, and I think people now recognize that putting an inflexible regime in place that won't allow for, you know, we think streaming technology is all the rage, but, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now, who knows what the new technology will be that will be challenging the copyright laws. So the hearings that will take place starting tomorrow morning, it's just the beginning of what I assume will be a series of hearings. One of the artist reps from Copyright Alliance will be testifying, among others, to speak about the ways in which as Congress and the legislators sit down and begin considering these things, they can hopefully put means in place that will go back to the original protections that we're supposed to be keeping in mind, which is, you know, to encourage the progress and innovation of the arts, right? So there is a push from folks like me and other like-minded people to really try and make that more of an artist-centric approach, which was sort of the original Copyright Act in 1909 was very artist-focused. And in the 70s, we went a little bit more towards, you know, copyright holder focused. Yeah. And I think there's a push now to go back to, you know, somewhere in the middle, but, you know, swinging back towards the artist end. So, as I said, I think that tomorrow will be interesting to see what the tone is, what some of the questions are that are asked, and maybe it'll give us a sneak peek as to what the legislators at least have decided are the important issues.
Yeah. And is there a place to keep a track of what's happening on that front in terms of the hearings or transcripts or videos or anything like that?
I'm not sure if it's going to be live streamed, but you could certainly look it up. It's the House Judiciary Committee, the Subcommittee on Intellectual Property. They have a website, so you might could look for the hearing. That's for tomorrow, Thursday, 9:30 a.m., and it's Goodlatte, Goodlatte. It's his hearing, so you could look and see if it's streamed. If not, they may have, they will almost certainly have transcripts and things like that available afterwards. If you'd like to follow my tweets, I'm going to try to live tweet from there. So if anything interesting comes up, I'll keep you posted.
Great. Awesome. Well, I'll let you go. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great to meet you guys.
That's great.
Have a good one.
Great. So let's carry on by talking about some more slightly lighter weight stuff, because we've covered policy a lot now. So I'm just going to move to something completely different. And Zach, you covered a story just yesterday, today or yesterday, you published a piece on a new gaming software. So this is called Gigit. And it's kind of Farmville meets a Rock Band, as you described in the article. And of course, I would encourage everybody to go and check out the article itself on Forbes.com. But could you tell us a little bit about what the company does and how they launched, essentially?
Yeah, so the company is it's a little confusing, because in some of their literature it says just Gigit, and in other parts it says Play Gigit. But right. The official name is Play Gigit, which is a little clunky. but I think what they're doing is pretty interesting. They've created a Facebook game. I mean, poured, I think, about $20 million into it. This guy, John Acunto, who's kind of a Web 1.0 guy. There's a VC firm that poured in about $10 million. They've got some private investors on board. They've got 70 artists on board, from 2 Chainz to Lil Wayne to Miguel to Nas, and Kevin Lyles is managing a bunch of artists now, former head of Def Jam, who was actually responsible for their video games, Vendetta and the like, in the mid-2000s. So they put together this huge game with all, this critical mass of supporters, and basically you log into Facebook, and you play it. I've never actually played Farmville, but I'm told it's kind of similar. you pick your team, and instead of you pick a rapper or a singer, and you plan out a concert, and you have a certain amount of money that you start with, and it costs more for a big venue, a big artist. You can pick songs, you can buy songs to with real money to play in your virtual world, or you can play that you have in your real collection. You basically, the better concert you put on, the more virtual guests you get, and the more virtual money you earn. Of course, you can spend real money to upgrade your virtual concert status, which I think is basically the Farmville angle. And then, in kind of the Rock Band side of things, you progress through your career sort of as a music mogul concert promoter, and by planning more and more lucrative tours and so forth. But the hook here is that, as I mentioned before, all the people who kind of signed on, they may be achieving, or at least they hope, something of a critical mass, such that, there's enough support, enough artists tweeting about it, to kind of get it off the ground. And from the artist's perspective, it's kind of a new arena for making money, because in this virtual world, where they're having their virtual concerts, they get paid whenever somebody buys their music through the game system. Yeah. There's a direct link where you can buy their merch through the game system. They can actually, if they have a clothing line, you can specify that they, that Lil Wayne wear a truck fit shirt, and then you can go and order the truck fit shirt through the game, blah, blah, blah. So, will it catch on? Who knows? But, they're definitely making a go of it. And, I've never been one to pay money to buy fake things pay real money to buy fake things in a fake universe, but a lot of people do. And, if Farmville can be as big as it is, I interviewed Kevin Lyles about this. He said, who really cares about a cow, right? Yeah. It's like, but you can get really passionate about your favorite artist in the way that you can't, or I couldn't get about a cow. Yeah. Maybe they're onto something. And at the very least, I think it's worth it, for some of these artists who are getting, decent advances. They wouldn't say exactly what, but some of the artists have actually invested in the company. I think some of them may have accepted equity in the company as kind of an advance payment, for getting involved. And it's just another way to sell, image and likeness, sell their music, sell their merch and so forth, which I thought was kind of an interesting an interesting kind of avenue to open up.
And particularly if they're going directly to the artists for this sort of thing. I mean, one of the big problems that artists have had with the streaming services is that they have to go through a record label intermediary to do business with Spotify or Pandora, and that oftentimes the big record labels end up eating up all of the economics of that transaction, you know, before the money actually trickles down to artists. And so if you can have a system, even if it's, you know, a fairly unconventional system, it's going to have to be a fairly unconventional system, in fact, where an artist can work directly with a new platform to get paid directly, then I think you're talking about the types of innovations that we were discussing a little bit earlier. I'm not saying that this one will actually, you know, be a revolutionary breakthrough, but it's a way for artists to make money without having to go through, you know, several different middlemen who end up making all of the money at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I can offer some insight on this because I actually worked for a music gaming company for a while that didn't work out. And one of the key issues that I think Zach, you were pointing out about trying to cut out the middleman is that if you're looking at doing a game that includes music, that becomes impossible, because even if you're doing a direct deal on the artist, on the merchandise, you're still going to have to go and license the tracks of the labels and go and license the tracks of the publisher if you're doing an actual game, because it becomes like a licensing situation, which is a track by track rather than blanket. And so that brings in even more middlemen, I guess, rather than cutting them out, because then you have to do a direct deal with the artist if they don't have a 360 deal for the merchandise side, and maybe even give them equity. You also have to pay a ton of money to the record label to license a track and promise them a cut of whatever money is generated from playing that track within your game. And you have to do the same with the publisher. So, I mean, yeah. I've been there, and it's very complicated. I really hope that somebody can crack that nut, because I think there's money there, but it's difficult money to extract, I think.
Yeah, well, and from a user perspective, you know, if you're the entrepreneur setting up this new platform, I mean, no user is going to want to use your music industry game unless you've got a lot of artists on there, and so you've got to cut deals with people who can provide you with a lot of artists, which typically tend to be these big labels. And so, you know, what we've seen with Pandora and Spotify and the streaming services is that those big labels end up getting the biggest slices of the pie, and we'll see if that plays off as we see new types of you know, disruptive media coming about.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, it's a question of seeing whether Facebook is still as relevant as it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and whether mobile is absolutely necessary now or not. Zach, anything? Sorry, I cut you off there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think another interesting thing is that, you know, we talk a lot about streaming as the future of the music business, and we talk about the idea of, you know, artists kind of getting their music out there and maybe not getting compensated very well or at all, but the idea of, you know, kind of spreading the word and really kind of cleaning up on the road and through merch and so forth. But I think I find this particularly interesting because it's sort of a way of doing that virtually, right? You know, virtually getting your merch and virtually, you know, doing these concerts. I mean, obviously it's not anywhere near as lucrative as actual concerts, but, you know, the kind of virtualization of some of these non-music revenue streams, you know, if it ever takes off, could be an interesting source for these guys.
Absolutely. I think it could be a big source. It's just a case of really finding a way to navigate all these different rights and managing to establish your business model in a way that it's workable for both the company that is trying to make this business model work and for the people that are trying to get paid from it, which are the artists. So that's really like a tough nut to crack. And I wanted to go back to sort of more heavyweight policy stuff now. We took a little bit of a break, but I wanted to talk about Pandora and also ask Zachary about your views on the copyright review as well. So first of all, let's go over the Pandora story. So we haven't really covered it in the past couple of weeks because Spotify really has taken over as the big baddie of the industry for a time, at least, until people stop talking about streaming rates. But the Pandora debate is still very much alive, even though no big headlines have happened in the last 3 weeks. And Greg Sandoval from The Verge had written a great piece about Pandora's PR problem about 3 weeks ago. We haven't really heard much in the way of a new rehashed Internet Radio Fairness Act, which was shut down last year. It didn't even make it out of committee. But when I was in DC last month, I could still hear a lot of people buzzing about the fact that this may come back to the floor at some point and it may be reintroduced in some other way. So do you feel that's something that Pandora is still keen on pushing, even after all the backlash? And can you see this as something that is going to come up when sessions resume in September?
I mean, it's hard to say whether or not it will actually, you know, get a serious hearing in the House this early, particularly just how crazy politics have been this year. And there's going to be a showdown over the debt ceiling again, it looks like. So there's going to be a lot of other stuff in D.C. that's going to be higher priority for people than this bill. But if it did have a path to some sort of serious consideration or potentially passage, I mean, you would have to see it moving beyond the type of debate we had last. I mean, last time it really just looked like Tim Westergren and Pandora trying to cut lower checks to artists. And that is not the PR position that Pandora wants to be in at all. It's not going to go anywhere when that's what it looks like. And I think realistically, he's going to need more allies. You know, you're not going to be able to do this alone, especially when the people who he has institutional opposition here from the record labels. It's one thing to have, you know, do-gooder consumers, artists saying, you know, well, this will hurt us. But when you have other corporate entities on Capitol Hill lobbying against you, it's really tough. That said, Jason Chaffetz, I talked to him a couple months ago at CPAC. Even at CPAC, he wanted, which is a big conservative political activism, you know, thing that happens in D.C., even at this, which is, you know, mostly about, you know, all kinds of social issues and things that, you know, musicians are often disinterested in or opposed to, he really wanted to make a big deal about how he'd sponsored the Pandora bill. And I think there is still, particularly in the Republican Party, this desire to kind of stop just being seen as like a party of sort of old line CEOs, and to continue, you know, to try and walk the walk a little bit with their talk about innovation and stuff and cozy up to some actually more innovative enterprises. But that said, all of these streaming services have got to figure out a way to make these deals much more palatable to artists. Because right now, they're getting pressed from both directions. You know, they're not actually making any money right now. The actual statutory royalty rates are too high. You can't run these services for a profit. And if you can't run these services for a profit, then, you know, artists are never going to get anything ever. But they've got to find a way to make things not look like a complete ripoff for artists. So that when high profile people like Tom York are leaving Spotify, that looks really bad for all the streaming companies, not just for Spotify. And in part, this is you know, the label's responsibility. But I think, you know, the labels are equity holders in Spotify. I mean, they've got to figure out a way to make this, you know, make this at least look better if they want to see something move politically.
Yeah, and Zach, from your view, you know, at Forbes, how do you see Pandora shaping up for the next few months? Of course, you know, I think Greg is very right in saying that Pandora needs to relook at its PR strategy and find a way to communicate better what it's trying to do and not fumble its messaging quite so much. And also, you know, maybe it's just blown out of proportion. And Pandora also made the wrong move in trying to request such a high cut in the royalty rates, while really, if it had managed to pass a 15 or 20% cut, which would be more reasonable, then the company would actually become a profitable one. And so that's, you know, a step forward certainly for them. So what are your thoughts on Pandora and on what's going to happen in the next couple of months?
I think it really... it comes down to, you know, in terms of the PR issue, you know, it's still an issue of scale with all these streaming services. We're still in the single digits of market share. Terrestrial radio is still, you know, the big giant in the room. And I honestly think that a lot of these complaints from artists are going to go away, you know, when those market share numbers start to go up. I mean, you know, who knows how long that'll take, but, you know, I mean, I forget the exact numbers, but was it in this low single-digit percentages for Spotify and for Pandora of the total overall, you know, music listening? Is it something very low? And it, you know,
it's very low. Yes.
That, if you multiply that by 10, you know, and then you multiply those checks by 10, you know, then I think that some of these artists are going to stop complaining so much. But I think the other big thing that nobody really talks about is that Pandora and Spotify, you know, all these streaming services actually pay, you know, recording artists as well as songwriters, unlike terrestrial radio. And people, I think, outside of the music industry don't realize that. And I think that fact, the argument for terrestrial radio was, we won't pay recording artists, we'll only pay publishers, because it's just good publicity for them, it's good promotion, which is the same argument that the streaming services are making now, but they're actually paying recording artists. To be fair, probably a lot of the artists who are big enough to be getting mainstream radio play, somebody like Rihanna, who's maybe not really writing her own songs at all, she maybe has gotten cut in on the publishing somehow, or at the very least she can really make it up on the touring side. But I think that the framework exists. Again, if the music industry can get this right, for streaming to more fairly compensate artists, because it compensates recording artists as well as songwriters. And I think that will that ever change with terrestrial radio? Highly unlikely, because it's so entrenched, and there's 100 years of history, and there are companies, lobby groups that have existed for decades and decades, who are entrenched and kind of have a lot invested in not making this happen. But you hear people like Irving Azoff talking about this a lot. Why doesn't terrestrial radio pay recording artists as well as songwriters? And again, I just think that as time goes on and these services start to scale more, some of these questions will go away when our artists start getting checks that are much bigger.
Absolutely. And Zachary, I was actually, I forgot to ask you earlier, one of the key issues that people are talking about on the other side of the spectrum, which is not on the side of Pandora and the Internet Radio Fairness Act, but on the side of trying to get terrestrial radios to square up and start paying, which they haven't done so far. A huge amount of corporate push from both sides. Here we're talking about the giants of radio, which are probably much bigger and more and better funded than the giants of the music industry. Of course, the music industry has got artists supporting it, which can be quite vocal about certain types of things. But I've heard, like, both at South by Southwest and in DC last month, so much talk about people trying to push for terrestrial radio to start paying. Do you think that's a feasible outlook? And, how would that materialize?
I think it's extremely unlikely that you will see any type of, mechanical royalty or whatever. I guess it wouldn't be mechanical if it's on terrestrial radio, but you would see any type of performance royalty coming out of Congress ever. Not just now, not just this month, ever. I think the industry has existed under this structure for a very long time.
Yeah.
The lobby groups that are at play here, I mean, I actually think that the record labels are much more influential inside the Beltway than the radio stations. They're not, they want that
more
money.
Glamorous.
they would love to get that money, and they have been able to get it for decades. I just really think it's unlikely that that's going to happen. And you'll get this pushback from terrestrial radio and from opponents of the bill, saying, look, why even bother with this? Radio works. Artists get paid from radio indirectly when they're songwriters. And in fact, I think Zach's totally right there when he says, the reason artists haven't really complained and made that big a fuss over terrestrial radio is because a lot of them are songwriters, and for a lot of them, the way they've actually made their money is not through record sales, but through songwriting royalties. And so people like radio because it's actually made them some money. I think in general, all of these debates, in order to get any kind of real grassroots support from musicians, they've got to find a way to bring smaller artists to the table and make them feel like they have a stake in things. And right now, terrestrial radio, even though it's such a big part of the market, there are only a handful of artists at any given time who are making a significant amount of money off of terrestrial radio, or who stand to make a significant amount of money. And if you want to bring in musicians generally, you've got to be able to say, well, look, you can make $3,000 or $4,000 a year off of this. You could make $30,000 or $40,000 a year off of this. Something that's not crazy big time money, but money that artists, musicians who are really struggling to make it, they don't make a whole lot of money. It doesn't actually take that much to appease them. But you've seen record labels and most of the industry infrastructure for decades be really not very open-minded to that sort of change. And I think, particularly if we moved from to a serious talk about, overhauling the copyright laws, or even to something, more finer-tuned about the Pandora bill, if the record labels could figure out a way to just throw little artists a tiny bone, I think you'd see a lot of the resistance go away politically. I think you would have a chance to move something. But right now, with the debt ceiling coming up and all sorts of other stuff, there's just no way we're going to see a change in terrestrial radio royalty in infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly. There's only so much that Congress can get through in one setting, and then I guess if we skip the next 8 to 10 months, then going to be election time.
No, I mean, I think, the radio stations don't have a good argument on the terrestrial on the performance royalties. I mean, they would lose, I think, on the merits. I think they've been losing on the merits for like 60 years, but they still don't have to pay the performance royalties.
That's right.
I just would be shocked if that changed.
Great. And I also wanted to mention for people to go and check out a study that was released by Spotify just at the end of last week that is penned by Will Page, who is their director of economics. And you can find that on press.spotify.com/US or somewhere around there you will find that link. And essentially, it seeks to look at what's happened in the Netherlands in the last couple of years since Spotify has taken foothold in the country. Of course, it doesn't quite go so far as to pen a direct correlation between the arrival of Spotify and figures on piracy, for example. But through an analysis of the P2P technology downloads, which was done by the company Music Metrics, it manages to pinpoint very accurately the data on piracy versus the data on Spotify stream versus the data on related sales. And that's a good place to start when looking at, for example, the effects of holdouts. So when artists decide not to put their albums on Spotify, so what happens then? Does the release get pirated more? Does it drive more sales? So what happens there? And there's a whole study around that, which is, I think, really interesting and quite in-depth. I think it's a 25-page report. So I would encourage your listeners to go and download that. But I wouldn't delve too much into it right now because it's quite detailed. And the last story I wanted to talk about today, well, it came up yesterday actually, it was broken by the Hollywood Reporter, and it's all about the songwriter Amy Mann that we wouldn't normally talk about her on the show. I guess she has actually filed a lawsuit against the digital music service MediaNet, and that was revealed yesterday, for infringing her copyright on a number of works. So the Hollywood Reporter report piece by Eric Gardner outlines pretty well Amy Mann's case. So essentially, she claims that MediaNet has been distributing 120 of her tracks without having a proper license. She says that her license expired 7 years ago, essentially. She sent a letter to stop the auto-renewal clause in her contract. She hasn't received any royalties from that. And that makes a very, very bad case for MediaNet if that's true. Of course, the CEO of MediaNet asked for a comment yesterday, and he said in the comment was that they deny these charges and that they think the matter will be resolved. So this is an interesting case, just because not just individually as a case, but because it pinpoints the fact that artists, as they understand how important digital is becoming for their revenues, are going to be more careful to really go deep into who has the music and how it's being used. Because, of course, we're dealing with catalogs of millions of tracks, especially if you ended up licensing your music to a label at some point, and maybe that was never taken off their catalog and it's licensed to another service and it ends up trickling down there. And so where does your money go? So do you feel like there's going to be a bit of a movement in the next few years where we're going to see more artists paying attention to where their music ends up and really tracing down the revenue stream and trying to understand whether they're actually getting any money from the services that it's on? Because that's, with hundreds of services around the world on digital music, it's actually not easy to keep track of all that. Zacho, what's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly examples like this will spur artists to be more vigilant. But it's interesting, of course, in the current era with things moving more and more toward digital, you would think that, I don't know, better records would be kept and there would be a clearer chain of,
you would think so,
where everything goes. But of course, it's just like the old days, where did all those records go? It seems to be just as difficult, to kind of keep track. So, I mean, I think as always, it's crucial for artists to have a vigilant team, to make sure that they stay in touch with their attorneys and agents and business managers, and that those intermediaries really kind of stay on top of these services to make sure that that the artists get paid. You know, or for enterprising artists, you know, to be, stay on the case yourself. I mean, I think you know, more and more from, you know, from the Pomplamooses all the way up to the Jay-Z's, you know, it's the artist doing everything, you know, on his or her own, from the music to the songwriting, to the physical recording, to, you know, to the harassing of business people to get their money, you know. And I think that, you know, although there are new examples, it's in some ways a similar story. You know, you just have to stay on top of the people who owe you money.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think Zachary, that brings us back to a point that's kind of like slightly unrelated, but in a way, because some of these companies have millions of tracks in their catalog, sometimes they can even keep track of contracts, what's happening, do we still own the rights to these tracks, have the licensing rights expired, what's going on, and it's actually pretty hard to keep track of that, especially if the artists in question are not large enough to have those teams that are supporting them and helping them understand what's happening on the legal front. So on that front, I kind of wanted to relate it to the issue of orphan works, because that's a really big issue that is going to be part of the copyright review that's going to happen in the US as well. And when I spoke to Maria Palante and a couple of other people that are involved last month, you know, orphan works seems like an issue that could perhaps be one of the first on the agenda, just because it's relatively separated and may not generate quite as much heat as some of the other issues that may be addressed during that review. So, do you feel like there's a big need to streamline the way in which rights are tracked and orphan works are also made available to the public or made available for use? And is there consequently a sort of a need to create a database like it's been touted, for example, where those rights are being tracked and where people can actually go and find out who owns what and whether that track is available or not? Is any of this feasible, or is it just too big of an undertaking for a government level agency to take on?
Well, you know, we do have a government that provides copyrights, that, you know, is in the business of issuing intellectual property protections for things. Yeah. And I don't think it's really too much to ask that be accompanied by a database and that database be kept up to date, and that the government have to have some, you know, accountable review process for maintaining that database. And I think taking that out of, you know, making that responsibility something that is public rather than the responsibility of every new service that's trying to innovate in this area is probably a really good idea. One way to lower some of the costs of some of the barriers to entry for these new types of businesses. I think it's a very good idea. And orphan works in particular, I mean, we're actually talking here, when, you know, an orphan work is basically a work that no one is interested in anymore. No one's making any money off of it. There isn't any actual, you know, any supply side from this piece of art, whatever it is. And so you would think institutionally that there would be at least less resistance to changing the copyright laws in that, or, you know, the standards in that regard, because nobody cares about these things anyway.
Yeah.
I think in practice, if you're actually talking about overhauling the copyright system, you're going to see a lot of resistance from record labels and publishers and pharmaceutical companies immediately, because they really like the existing system. Even as bad as the music market has been for the last decade, they really, really want to make sure that, you know, they have the strongest and longest copyright, you know, protections possible.
Yeah.
And it's weird how these things in Washington can be sort of like emotional and not rational. I mean, none of these labels have any actual financial interest in orphan works. That's why they're orphan works.
Yeah.
But the idea of opening the door a little bit, well, what if something else happened later on, sort of goes into the minds of these companies and these lobbyists, sure. And they push back. But I think, you know, maintaining a database like that, I mean, that's you're not talking about any new government regulation there. You're not talking about even changing the rules. You're just talking about making things work better and a little more efficiently. And that's something in the digital age that ought to be, I think, a no-brainer. This is something the government can maintain for a very low cost, and that would provide some transparency. You know, when Amy Mann brings this type of lawsuit, you know, when she complains and her stuff gets lost in the shuffle, let's make the most charitable case for the company here. Let's just say they've been trying to play fair the whole time and you know, have just lost things in the shuffle. You know, it would be really easy to check and see what happened there. You know, just go to the database. Oh, yep. Amy Mann stuff, we don't have those rights, or we do have those rights. And you could resolve this without a you know, a drawn out legal battle,
yeah.
Which ultimately would be good for artists like Amy Mann, who is, you know, I think she's still in the category of people who are making enough money for music that it's kind of a luxury to be able to challenge these things.
Yeah. But it's expensive.
Yeah, it is, and there's actually enough money in it for her that it's worth making a fuss over. I mean, a lot of artists, you know, okay, well, if you know if you're getting screwed over by Spotify or something, and they actually owe you like $40, then why bother? You know, it's not worth it.
Yeah, it's absolutely a fair point. Then, of course, you know, I wasn't trying to imply that tracks that are where the licensing has lapsed should go into Orphan Works. I was just making the point that there's lack of a database, and so we can't really keep track of any of that data, and so. Then how can you make any argument pro or against? It becomes really difficult. I mean, I dealt with licensing older tracks. You know, we're talking about 30, 40 years old, where you have to go through the paperwork and you have to really go through the contracts, and they have to dig them up, and it's difficult because it's still a paper world, which is absolutely insane. But that's how it is. You can't keep track of millions of tracks electronically, apparently. So.
Well, that gives these services an incentive to just do business with the bigger companies too, and the bigger labels, because well, I know what our deal is with EMI. I know what our deal is with Universal. Like you don't have to wonder like, okay, which little artist are you? I mean, it ends up saving the services time, and that ends up being bad for smaller artists.
Yeah. And Zach, just to finish with you, I wanted to ask you how is your have you spoken to any technology companies about problems of, for example, acquiring rights or acquiring information about rights? And do you feel like this process got any easier? I mean, I know that Harry Fox and also MediaNet to an extent have tried to start providing it. You know, Harry Fox, of course, much more so than MediaNet, but they're providing information on rights holders and publishing information and all that. But smaller companies, are they having difficulty? I mean, I know from London that they are for sure here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think again with small companies, it's very anecdotal. It goes on a case by case basis. But you know, regardless of the reforms and the efforts and so forth, you know, it's kind of a big scary world, and it's kind of hard to you know to wrap your mind around it if you're a small company, and you know, and to kind of get the time of day from some of these companies. So you know, I think again, it's total case by case basis, and it would really depend on the company. But you know. Certainly, steps in the right direction, I think, is what's going on now, and hopefully for everyone, they continue.
Yeah. Hopefully that's really the hope. Guys, it was absolutely a pleasure having you on the show. I just wanted to go run by you and ask if there's anything in particular that you want to plug, or otherwise just plug your company's website, your own website, or your Twitter handle, whatever you like. And so, Zachary, do you want to go first?
Sure. I write for the Huffington Post. You can see me on HuffPost Live every now and then. And my band Drunk Tigers has our EP coming out on Funny Not Funny Records in September.
Awesome. Awesome news. I'll check that out. Is it going to be on Spotify?
Yeah, I think it is. We have a little deal where we'll collect you know, dozens of pennies from Spotify and Pandora.
Great. So, you'll get a whole maybe like 20 pennies for me? Yeah, if I listen to it twice, you know.
We're going to make millions. We're going to be huge. Why am I downplaying it? Of course,
that's great. And Zach, from your end, how do people find out about your work at Forbes?
Yeah, you can go to Forbes.com or you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Zogblog. It's Zogblog, and I tweet out all of the links to the articles that I write.
That's great. Awesome handle. Well, thanks very much, guys, for staying with me for this hour. And thanks so much for listening. Digital Music Trends is available on a variety of platforms as audio and video. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel on youtube.com/digitalmusictrends and on SoundCloud on soundcloud.com/digitalmusictrends. Have a great week, and until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.